It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A protest last weekend in Charlottesville over the removal of a Confederate statue had already turned violent when a young woman, a counter-protester against white nationalism and white supremacy, was run down. Reaction was quick across the country, including here in Pittsburgh, but concerns have not faded after those initial vigils of support. There are worries that protests and counter-protests could pop up in Pittsburgh this weekend, especially after one at Google was already in the works. Joining us in studio, Rebecca Addison, news editor for Pittsburgh City Paper, Virginia Alvino-Young, race and equity reporter for WESA, and Julian Routh, reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome to all of you.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks for having us.
If you have a question or comment, please tweet us and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. Whether it was from Sunday's vigil or talking with people since what has been the feeling that you've been getting from visiting with folks, reacting, first of all, to Charlottesville? Julian, let's start with you.
Kevin, I think there's a lot of shock, some justified shock going around. At that vigil in Schenley Plaza last weekend, right after the events of Charlottesville, the quickly planned vigil there, I ran into a civil rights leader, Tim Stevens, who had said he couldn't believe that in 2017 he was looking at images of people carrying torches around the streets. But I also got a sense that, the question is, what's next? How can the left unify a movement and take this forward and sustain their activism? But like I said, Kevin, just a lot of shock.
I would add to that that in addition to some who are shocked, some are just fundamentally not shocked. These are activists, black activists, allies right here in Pittsburgh that gathered just this week to try and formulate what their response was going to be. How can Pittsburgh get together and come together to respond in some way? And just saying, we see this all of the time. Sometimes it's in the form of really blatant exercises and anti-black, anti-minority sentiments. Sometimes it's just the systemic problems that they're seeing and that they have seen and that their mothers and fathers and grandfathers have seen. So also a lot of sadness, but not a lot of surprise for some.
Rebecca?
Yeah, I'd agree that a lot of the people I've talked to were not shocked by what happened in Charlottesville. They have been essentially waiting for this kind of action to take place since President Trump was elected, because they feel that he emboldened this kind of behavior.
Well, let's follow up with that. I wanted to ask you, what have people been saying? Have you been asking them about the president's comments? First, they were one thing, then they changed a bit. They seemed to soften a bit. And then it's back to where the original comments were, quote, blaming both sides for the violence in Charlottesville. So what have you been hearing about reaction to the president's comments?
Well, from the people I've talked to in this case, definitely not shocked at all there. The first statement, a lot of people said, certainly wasn't enough. Then the press conference seemed to be a little bit too much all over the place there, refusing to strongly condemn Nazis and the KKK and blaming violence from all sides and also promoting the phrase the alt-left. A lot of people don't really know where to go from here in terms of what to expect from the president in this matter. I wonder if he'll try to reaffirm his position again or offer some tweets for us here.
I think U.S. Senator Bob Casey said it best when he said that he was highly offended by the president's comments. Senator Casey was in town this week at two events in Pittsburgh, and he was basically saying that when President Trump said there were fine people on both sides, that, he was raised to believe that fine people, like people who preach hate, are not fine people.
And Governor Wolf sort of echoed Casey's comments, Virginia.
Yeah, I mean, we're hearing a lot of condemnation from leadership at all levels of government and certainly from activists on the ground. But I think the biggest concern, like Rebecca mentioned, is what is the effect that this is having on the organized alt-right groups? Is this emboldening them even further? A lot of statements that we're seeing now on Twitter from some of that leadership is basically saying, well, see, the man in the Oval Office is basically you know, not condemning strongly what we're doing. They're reading through the lines on that and saying what we're doing is okay. That's what people are concerned about.
We've heard some Republican elected leaders from other parts of the country criticizing the president. We had anything from Republican members of Congress from Pennsylvania or Senator Toomey? I have not heard anything. Have we heard anything?
So we at City Paper got a statement from Senator Toomey where he did denounce the people in Charlottesville. He wasn't as critical of the president, but he at least did, you know, the easy layup, which is, you know, denouncing neo-Nazis.
Okay. All right. Virginia, earlier this week, you went out to export in Westmoreland County. First of all, you want to get further reaction after Sunday's vigil here in Pittsburgh. Why did you choose export?
Yeah, we did hear from a lot of urban voices here at that vigil. But how are folks in our surrounding areas reacting? Plus, export sort of came onto the map about 5 years ago when there was a scheduled KKK regional meeting that was happening there. Some headlines called it a rally. Residents will tell you there was no rally, no torches, anything like that. But there was a statement in other publications by some of the KKK leadership that these are private meetings and these are mandatory meetings that leadership comes together and has, and that allegedly happened in export.
Well, of course, 20 years ago here in Pittsburgh on the steps of the city county building, there was an official KKK rally. About 40 or so Klansmen took part. And so they were on the steps and
right,
then
not so hidden. Right.
Yes, not so hidden. And hundreds of protesters or anti-Klan protesters were in the parking lot across Grant Street. And Grant Street served as sort of the buffer. That's where the media stood and had debris thrown over their heads from that was 20 years ago. So export turned. So anyway, let's talk about export. And you talked with Sherry Stover and you asked her about evidence. Is there any evidence of the Klan in that area?
But it's not a group so much. It's an individual, narrow-minded, but like an Archie Bunker, so to speak, kind of person. And that's the way they were raised. And you hear the occasional slang terms and you know where they're going.
Right. I mean, she's basically saying she's been here all her life. She'd be really surprised if any of the old timers there at the Italian American Club where she's the manager are like Klan members and actually acting on those ideologies. So she hasn't seen any evidence of that from her neighbors or friends, any whispers at the bar even. But their language really implies that they're maybe more sympathetic to what we saw happen in Charlottesville.
Klan sort of organized, but is sort of and Rebecca and Julian, in your reporting, are you getting any sentiments of or any indications that sentiment of the Klansmen might be still pervasive or alive in the region, even if it is not associated with the Klan?
So, I mean, first I had to point out that I think 4 years ago in Greensburg, there were Klan flyers posted. And I was working for another newspaper at that time, and we had done a story about, you know, that it looked like the KKK was trying to recruit in Greensburg. So there is definitely a Klan presence in this region, for sure. But I think we do often see this kind of, I mean, the woman, I've heard the phrase Archie Bunker used to refer to this kind of mentality over and over and over again. And I think they use that as a way to kind of excuse it.
Yeah, like softens it a little bit.
Yeah, because, you know, Archie Bunker was kind of funny, right? And so that he can't be that bad. But yeah, I've heard that growing up in Western Pennsylvania and in interviews with people about this kind of mentality that is very pervasive in this region.
So let's hear from another person that you talked to when you were out in Westmoreland County. This is Ernie Miller. Who is he, Virginia?
Yeah, he's just a retired guy hanging out at the Italian American Club, lived in Westmoreland County for quite a while, and basically, you know, without giving a lot of specifics, told me that he feels like white people's rights have been taken away in recent years.
I can't identify with the American Nazi Party or the Ku Klux Klan or anything like that, but I can say that there's a whole lot of white people that are just disgusted with the way things are going in this country, and they're frustrated. So when you're frustrated, you're going to lash out, and I can understand that.
He can understand people lashing out, so he can't identify with the for neo-Nazis or any such groups, but there is, have you heard of any similar sentiments in your reporting, Julian and Rebecca?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and you mentioned an easy layup before to distance yourself and condemn neo-Nazis and the KKK, but the frustration among some people of where they think the country is headed, and they did take that frustration to the voter booth a couple of months ago and vote for Donald Trump. I think that that is a sentiment that's shared among a lot of people, and this frustration is something that I think is festering.
Yeah, I think it's more what we see nowadays are these kinds of microaggressions, I would even say. And they're not micro. For instance, someone I know this week had hired an Uber, and the driver told them that he doesn't, quote, drive big black men. Didn't accept the ride, moved on. These are kinds of things that black people experience in Pittsburgh every day. And, yeah, no one has a torch in their face and is, you know, saying the N-word. But these are the kinds of things that people experience every day. And now we're seeing this, especially with other minorities like Mexican-Americans, who I got another report recently of a young woman who was with her niece at a restaurant. The niece started speaking a different language to the people in the restaurant, and they started, people behind her started chanting, "Go back to Mexico." These are kinds of things that happen every day in this country. They're not people with Nazi flags and pitchforks and torches. They're just these kinds of aggressions that happen every day.
And to be clear about most of the people that I spoke to in Export were not saying, you know, they said very clearly that the violence is terrible. It's hard that they're watching it on TV. They worry about their children seeing things like that. They're absolutely not approving of, as they would say, either side sort of being violent or aggressive. But then, you know, you do hear from your Ernie Millers who maybe have a little bit more nuanced, non-explicit racism that they're spouting.
Is there a feeling of frustration from people who are concerned about this violence and what can be done? How do you change people's minds, attitudes? Are they just throwing up their hands, hoping, or by protesting, they hope that message sinks in?
I mean, amongst Pittsburgh activists, I would say there are sort of, to generalize, two schools of thought as far as what tact is going to be most appropriate or effective by the community or that the community should really take part of. And that's really, you know, step back or step up. And that's a clear divide. There are people who say, no, let's take back the narrative. Let's focus on our communities. Let's have these counter events. There's a peaceful march planned on Saturday. Let's have this like black family reunion. Like, let's show each other some love and, you know, let the Nazis just, you know, be alone. Others remember the rally from 1997, experience these microaggressions every single day and say the only thing that we can do is to show them that we're bigger and that we're not going to stand for this.
I want to touch upon physical symbols. And, of course, the event in Charlottesville, which turned out to be deadly, started with a protest about the planned removal of the statue of Robert E. Lee. No Confederate statues in Pittsburgh, but there's long been a controversial statue in Oakland, that of composer, Pittsburgh native Stephen Foster. He's immaculately dressed, and at Foster's feet is a barefoot banjo-playing black man. It was commissioned in 1900 by a local newspaper editor. Other cities have installed police guards for statues like this right now. So what's the reaction like in Pittsburgh? City's planning department, art commission are discussing this. Have we heard any planning about waiting for, responding to protest around a statue such as that of Stephen Foster? Are we aware? They're just, it's a reaction is as far as the police are wondering, or do we know of any plans? Are they being secretive about their plans?
Well, I believe the mayor's official statement is that there is a commission that's sort of looking to gather all of the historical evidence. I'm not sure the extent to which public feedback will play into their planning process, however. But at least as far as social media goes, I'd say there's a somewhat homogenous reaction in terms of, you know, people have long been upset about this statue.
Okay. So. Well, I spoke with Renee Pichocki. She's the director of the Office of Public Art. That is not a city department. And she talked about the factors that need to be considered when displaying art in public.
What is placed on public property is an indication of what a place values. And I think one of the reasons why this Stephen Foster sculpture has caused a lot of self-reflection and discussion, anger, hurt feelings, is because I don't believe Pittsburgh values causing people pain with derogatory images and content. My position is that the accomplishments and memory of any individual doesn't need to be celebrated with imagery or content that is painful or racist or derogatory. And personally, I support a process to remove this work of art from public property. Unfortunately, I think some people could feel like, well, you know, this is content that only hurts, you know, one group. And are we going to, you know, revise every single thing in public space because of this group or that group is upset? And I would like to counter that. When you have imagery that is painful or derogatory or racist, it hurts everyone. It hurts the entire city.
So, yeah, after the last year, the issues around the Confederate flag that we saw happening around the country, it was interesting that, you know, no one had brought up the statue then, because now that we've actually taken the time to look, you know, what we have, what are we portraying in Pittsburgh, you know, that might be offensive to people and hurtful to people, that immediately everyone pointed to this statue and as an example of something that should be removed. I haven't heard about any protests of people who are going to, you know, try to forcefully take it down. But I think a lot of people have woken up and realized that this is a problem.
Yeah, I think a lot of people share the same sentiment as that clip that you played there. I think that what you're seeing in Baltimore, where the mayor took it upon herself to have some of those statues removed, I think this is a time that's been a long time coming, where cities are going to have to re-examine their identity, re-examine the symbols that they're displaying. And also, you know, you also have to take into consideration the way that the president has equated Robert E. Lee to, you know, George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. I think that this is going to be a time where all cities are going to have to re-examine the symbols.
All right. So it is up to the city. People think because of the proximity to the University of Pittsburgh, it is a university decision, but it is actually up to the city to decide the fate, the future of this statue. What do we know? I mean, there was supposed to be a march on Google Saturday because of the dismissal of an employee who didn't like a company policy. And then the organizer said that he was canceling it because he claimed there were threats against them. But what sort of events are happening this weekend? Is there any expectation of other things popping up, whether you're hearing things on social media or whether they are truly organized? I think there's a march in the Homewood area, or just a vigil in the Homewood area that's just meant to be a weekend event.
Yeah.
So, Virginia.
I mean, there's the possibility of something happening at Bakery Square still. I mean, police have officially said that they're keeping an eye on everything, but they've also, you know, monitoring social media, things like that. But they've also explicitly said, you know, there's reason to believe that something may still happen. Of course, the event was officially canceled, but, you know, you never know. Activists are concerned that something might come up as well. So they're taking precautions to make sure that anybody who does show up is staying safe. But again, that's the sort of step up side of the activists. The other side are saying, you know, let's have something that is really in honor of our community by, for, and in the communities that they feel are most effective. So they're going to be having a march on a peaceful march and gathering on Saturday. So barbecue, music, family friendly, they're saying. So that's 1 to 5 this weekend. And they're also encouraging people to attend any other Black-centered events that are going on throughout the weekend, including some events happening in the Hill District and the like.
And I think it's worth pointing out, and I'm not sure if you guys have found your reporting, but I believe that our reporting hasn't found any credible evidence of there being alt-left threats that canceled this event.
Yeah, it's trying to prove a negative, trying to prove that there were no threats.
It's challenging. And I mean, what do you do when it comes to social media? And I think we on our reporting end are trying to tease apart what exactly city officials and public safety officials mean when they are talking about threats. We know that they monitor social media channels, but what else constitutes that concern and how are they preparing for it? We do know, though, that there'll be lots of officers on duty this weekend and prepared for any pop-up protests or other types of events that might come up.
And the city held a downtown. They held a prayer vigil today at noon. Rebecca, before we run out of time, I want to ask you about a new partnership that City Papers launched. Tell us about Documenting Hate.
So, yeah, the two incidents that I mentioned earlier about the man who was denied an Uber ride and the woman and young girl who were told go back to Mexico. These are the kinds of things that we want to document through our Documenting Hate project. We've partnered with ProPublica along with, I think, hundreds now of publications around the country who are in different cities who have joined in. And it's looking at, you know, our reporting of hate crimes that have to meet, you know, a certain set of legal requirements is already not good. But what also is lacking is our reporting on these kinds of incidents, these everyday incidents that people experience that really paint a picture of what I think minorities and marginalized groups are dealing with in Pittsburgh and around the country.
Well, we'll look forward to those reports. I want to know how the newsrooms will be covering these issues going forward. Julian, what are the plans, near term, long term?
Well, we're trying to parse through how to cover, especially both of the extremist sides, and also trying to distinguish between, you know, which groups are the alt-right, which groups are simply right-wingers. I think there's a lot of self-examining we're going to have to do, and a lot of newsrooms are going to have to do. And I think we also want to cover more events that are related to underrepresented communities, and that's always a focus of ours and mine.
And Virginia.
Going forward, a lot to learn, a lot to think about in terms of strategy. A lot of people point to the media as being a really key component as about what happens, who is being paid attention to. Is this just a platform for hate? Are we paying enough time, sort of enough attention in between things happening, or do we only look when something bad happens? Because there are a lot of people in Pittsburgh doing a lot of work and having a lot of challenges along the way. What are those stories in between? So it's really keeping an ear to the ground going forward and teasing apart what we can learn from really what transpires this weekend.
All right. Rebecca Addison is the news editor of Pittsburgh City Paper. Virginia Alvino Young is WESA's race and equity reporter. And Julian Routh is a reporter for the Post-Gazette. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
Coming up, moving traffic through Pittsburgh streets in a smarter, responsive manner. That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Washington, Pennsylvania hosts the first Pony World Series in 1952. The organization is a transition league for 13 and 14-year-old baseball players graduating from Little League teams. The first World Series included 505 teams in 106 leagues from around the country. Now there are more than 4,000 leagues in 40 countries worldwide. The series is televised every year from Washington's Lou Hay Pony Field. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for August 18th, 2017.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're stuck in bumper-to-bumper traffic. It's barely moving. You become frustrated, maybe beep your horn. You're stopped at a red light, which seems to be lasting an eternity. And there's no traffic coming through that intersection, but it still has the green light. Now there's a plan that might alleviate some of that frustration. City of Pittsburgh and PennDOT want to install smart lights, adaptive traffic signals, at some 126 intersections around downtown over the next 3 years. Joining us to discuss this smart idea and its chances, Ed Blazina, who covers transportation issues for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome back to the program, Ed. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
And you can join the conversation by tweeting your comment or question and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. All right, Ed, you reported on that the city submitted a proposal to the Southwestern Pennsylvania Commission earlier this month to be included as an amendment to their regional transportation plan. Remind us, the 10 County Commission, who are they and what exactly do they do?
They are the Southwestern Pennsylvania Commission. They are in charge of planning regional transportation projects. Projects that don't have their blessing can't get federal funding. The representatives from each of the 10 counties on the commission, I think each county has three representatives, plus the city of Pittsburgh.
Do they have any sway with any state funding that might be involved in a multi-funded project?
Yes, usually anything that comes through the region, whether it's state or federal, actually has to have their blessing. They're kind of the vetting process.
Okay. So the project would cost how much?
This particular project would cost about $30 million. About $12 million of that is federal money coming basically as a result of the Smart Cities program that the Department of Transportation ran last year.
So they liked that aspect of it, the adaptive signals.
That's correct. The city put in as part of its proposal what they call smart spines.
Okay.
Eight basically feeder roads into downtown where they would install a series of very technical smart traffic light systems to move traffic through there in a quicker manner.
So the city of Pittsburgh did not get that big grant, the Smart Cities grant. I think I went to Columbus, as I recall.
That's correct.
But the Department of Transportation liked, as you said, the adaptive signals approach.
Yes, they liked that. And actually, there are a couple of other things they funded as well. They said at the time when they chose Columbus that a lot of the cities had real good ideas and that they were going to try to find money to fund parts of them where they could. This is one aspect of that that is moving ahead.
Okay, we talked funding. Let's get to the fun part. I mean, this technology, I think, to me, is amazing. Who developed the technology? Who are the brains behind this?
One of the biggest developers of that technology is Carnegie Mellon University. They developed what's called the SureTrack system that's used right now on an experimental basis out in the East Liberty area.
Okay.
There are other manufacturers across the country. As this moves ahead, the folks at PennDOT who will be managing this project say anybody can bid on it. They're not sold. They're not committed to using only the SureTrack system. They can use almost anybody that meets the specifications. And what these systems do is they work with a variety of monitors. They use radar. They use cameras. They use computer systems to basically tell where the traffic is. There's a system now that's being used out in the Murraysville to Monroeville area. 17 traffic lights are coordinated. And if you catch it just right, you can go through each one of those lights without stopping. The folks on the side roads have to wait for that traffic to move through.
I was talking to a colleague about this, and she was asking me what was on the show today, and I mentioned that, and you'd be talking about the adaptive signals. And she goes, I love it that they were installed in Murraysville, Monroeville. It made my commute so much better.
Yes. The folks who sit on the side streets might not be quite as happy. Those signals are set up so that once it reaches a certain point on the side streets, then they will change. But if you catch it just right, you can go through 17 straight signals without stopping.
You alluded to the sort of the experimental phase of this. I believe it started like in 2012, actually, with a handful of intersections and expanded last year to about four dozen?
That's correct.
Okay. So, and that's in the East Liberty to downtown area.
Yes.
So I remember visiting the folks at CMU's Traffic 21 initiative last year. It's amazing, this technology. Can you explain to us better how it works? I'm in a car. I approach this. There's no traffic coming the other – well, I shouldn't say the other way, but the perpendicular way at that intersection. How does this work?
It works a number of ways. There are sensors in the ground. There are cameras that watch the intersections. They're all hooked up with centralized computer system. That system then says where traffic – needs to move. If there's no cross traffic, that light will change and you'll be able to move forward.
It's that simple. Now, my cards, is there any need to be any sensor or reflective device or anything on private vehicles?
Not at this point, but that's coming. I mean, there is going to be technology that allows vehicles to essentially talk to each other.
Are they also planning on bikes, so cyclists and even pedestrians that come to those red lights and, you know, not crossing the street because they've got the green, but nobody's coming on the green light?
Yes. Those things are all picked up by the sensors. There's radar involved as well.
It is amazing. So this project, this $30 million that you mentioned, also includes a traffic management center downtown. What would that do?
That'll work differently than these spines. That will work mostly with cameras and a central place where essentially somebody's monitoring the pictures that they're seeing where traffic is built up and changing lights accordingly.
Okay. Now, the adaptive signals, they're included, I read in your report, they're included in the bus rapid transit project that is also proposed. The official, I think, proposal goes into the federal government next month, I believe it is, involving 50 intersections. So how will that work? And will the signals give priority to the buses, but will that delay people in their own cars? How's that going to work?
It will give priority to the buses. The buses will have queuing lanes where they can actually go first when the light turns. You'll be sitting at the traffic light with a bus beside you. He'll get the right of way, and you won't.
All right. So benefits, other than reducing people's frustration, travel time reduced. Let's listen to Steve Smith. He heads the Intelligent Coordination Logistics Lab, and he said on average a 25% reduction in travel time.
Not because cars are going faster necessarily, but they're stopping 30% less time. And when they do stop, we reduce idle time by over 40%.
And in addition to that, I believe there also is another impact. It has to do with emissions.
Absolutely.
I mean, and that seems logical. You're not stopped at a red light. You're not idling. And so the emissions get reduced.
Part of the proposal for the bus rapid transit system, which goes from downtown to Oakland through uptown, has to do with reducing the amount of air pollution in uptown. That's one of the worst areas in the county because it has highways on both sides, and I guess the air gets trapped in there. And as a result, you have serious pollution problems. If you can move vehicles through there in a quicker manner and reduce the number of vehicles going through, then you reduce the air pollution.
You talked with, I believe, was it Karina Ricks?
Yes.
From the city's Department of Mobility and Infrastructure. She is bullish on this in terms of this could be like a national model.
Yes, indeed. The expectation is that over the next 2 or 3 years, as this is installed, no other city in the country will have as extensive use of this as Pittsburgh has. Essentially, they're going to take 8 of the main routes that come into downtown, and the goal is to make the traffic move much more freely on those routes.
All right, Ed, our final quick question, that is Southwest Pennsylvania Commission, I believe, meets next month. They're taking, I believe, public input right now on the money for this $30 million project. When might we expect a decision from the commission?
They meet the 25th of September. They should decide that day. It would be a major surprise if it was not approved.
All right. Ed Blazina covers transportation issues for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Ed, thanks so much as always.
You're welcome.
Coming up, look to the sky, but only if you have the right viewing devices. We're going to talk about Monday's eclipse and the buzz it's generating. That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. The Carnegie Science Center and Pittsburgh Children's Museum are just a couple of local places preparing for solar eclipse viewing parties. The eclipse is expected to be seen in Pittsburgh around 2:30 p.m. Monday. And after struggling for decades, Conneaut Lake Park is finally turning a profit. Park officials say sales are up more than 50% from this time last year. Find more at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The start of a new academic year is being delayed by some schools. People are taking off work. It's part of the freshman orientation event at Carnegie Mellon University. It's Monday's solar eclipse. We're going to talk about what you need to know about some of the fun things about the eclipse with Bob Batts, Jr., reporter for the Post-Gazette. Welcome to the program, Bob.
Thank you, sir.
And with WESA's Katie Blackley, our lead reporter on the Good Question series. Katie, welcome.
Hello, Kevin.
And also joining us, Mike Warshak, an investigative reporter for the Caucus, who's not investigating this, who's not really covering this, but his natural curiosity has spurred plans for a lengthy drive through Tennessee. Thanks for joining us, Mike.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
Okay, if you have a question or comment, tweet us and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. All right, some of us don't remember from our basic science courses, what is a total eclipse and just how rare is it? Who wants to provide the scientific knowledge?
All right, so a solar eclipse happens when the moon passes between the Earth and the sun, and the moon's shadow then is cast on the planet in, you know, these things happen 3 to 5 times a year. They usually happen in a pretty narrow band, and there are 3 different kinds. There's a partial eclipse, which we're going to be seeing, well, which you'll be seeing up here in Pittsburgh.
Oh, you'll be seeing the full eclipse.
I'll be seeing the total eclipse, which is when the moon completely covers the sun. And then there's a third kind called an annular eclipse. When the moon is a little further away from the Earth, it gets in between us and the sun, and you can actually see the sun around the outside of the moon.
Well, right, I may not know as much science as you, but it also means the end of the world, doesn't it? I mean, so I've heard.
It depends if we can stop the dragon that's eating it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, so why all the buzz? Katie and Bob, you've been covering the buzz and finding fun stories about this. Why all the buzz? Is it the rarity of it? Is it the scientific nature, the historical aspect, Bob?
It's the size of it, for one thing. The last time an eclipse went all the way across the continent was in 1918 and stayed. So it's going to be visible by millions of people. And the last eclipse visible from the North America was in 1979. We were talking outside. That was pre-social media, pre-Facebook, pre-all this hype. So it's kind of crazy how it's even blowing up today, I think, too, if we're watching these different aspects of it.
And I think NASA's really taking advantage of the fact that all these things are coming together. Their website is incredibly interactive. They have all the different ways to see it, all the different times, all the different things you can build. These solar eclipse glasses, these pinhole projectors, and a list of just events and activities around your region. You can see them.
Yeah, you think NASA's kind of science geeky, but they've been having fun with this for months, and they're helping to organize events from Oregon all the way to the South Carolina coast. I love these museums that are doing total eclipse of the art events. You can watch it from an aircraft carrier. You can watch it from a jetliner. It's crazy, the stuff that you can do.
This is got to be a great for science, actually, because too often science is criticized. It's not accessible to just the common person. But you can take a rare event such as this and make it fun, and people learn from it as well by everybody.
It almost forces you to get involved in a way. I mean, solar eclipses were the catalyst for the birth of astronomy. It's what got us interested in trying to figure out what was going on up there. Eclipses led to the discovery of helium. That's how we discovered that element. Einstein's theory of general relativity was proved when in that 1918 eclipse, when he had made this crazy prediction that gravity could bend light, which seemed nuts. It was, you know, overturning Isaac Newton. And yet we saw a solar eclipse, and sure enough, there was light from a star that came right around the edge of the sun that we shouldn't have been able to see. And it proved him right. I mean, this science and solar eclipses are just made for each other. They really force you to get involved and pay attention to these things.
And there's a lot of science. Katie and I got to watch a test flight of the Pitt weather balloon. They're part of this national NASA project to launch weather balloons along the path of the eclipse.
Well, let's talk about that, because that happened in July, I believe. So what was the purpose of it and what was learned? We'll start with you, Katie.
So yeah, Pitt astronomy, physics, engineering students, they call themselves the Pitt Shadow Bandits. They're part of 54 teams across the country that are launching this high altitude balloon to the edge of the Earth's atmosphere. So that's between 85,000 and 105,000 feet. They said it's going to be an hour and a half to get up there. Mm-hmm. And so if you can picture just this giant teardrop balloon with this string that has a payload, and it's 3 stories long. So this payload is 12 pounds, and inside of it, they have Raspberry computers, light and heat sensors, modems, cameras, and like a cutaway system. So what they're trying to do is get all the way up there, and they're going to live stream the eclipse, and all of that's going to be on the NASA website. And they're also chasing what are called shadow bands, which, do you want to talk about what shadow bands are?
Yeah, and shadow bands are one of the interesting, real scientific things that the Pitt team is going to look for. A lot of these teams are from universities, high schools, and some of them are doing their own experiments as well. And a number of them are taking up bacteria to see how it reacts to the atmosphere and the temperature and as a way of preparing for more Mars exploration. But the shadow bands, apparently, if you're in an area of totality, like you're going to be, right before everything goes dark and right after it starts to get light again, there's supposed to be this phenomenon called shadow bands. It's like light and dark bands, like a rippling of a candle in the wind. It's okay. Really, I haven't seen them. One of the guys on the Pitt team has. They're going to use some of the equipment on the payload of the balloon is going to look for them on the edge of space. And down on the ground, they're going to look for them with an iPad they have set up to look for them against a white background. But it's really cool because no matter what they find, they're going to further the science of, are these things atmospheric? Well, if they see them up in the edge of space, they're not. If they see them down on the ground. So they're just doing real science, plus all this other cool stuff that they're doing. What's great about their payload is they build it all themselves. It looks like a bomb. It's like little tiny Raspberry Pi computers with red and green lights that flicker when they go on. They're encased in this foam and cardboard stuff that these students made. It looks like my 10-year-old made it, but yeah. It's real science. And, you know, that also is science. It's not – a lot of it's kind of gritty pipe cleaner wire. It's fabulous. They're just hoping it actually gets up there without the balloon popping. Then they got to go find it after it falls down with their parachutes.
When Bob and I were there, they were taping, it was like colored duct tape around it to fix some things and just make it colorful too. And they have a high frequency satellite or something that can predict between 20 miles where it's going to fall. So when they launched it, they predicted it was going to be in Indiana, PA, and it actually ended up in Salzburg, which is a little more than 20 miles. But when they go to Springfield, Tennessee, they can know about where it's going to be.
All right. Speaking of Tennessee, Mike, you're going to Tennessee? So 80% blockage here in the Pittsburgh area is not good enough for you. You are going to Tennessee? Why? You're not going to report on it, are you?
I'm not. No. This happened about a month or two ago. This trip just came together because my wife and I were discussing it. And, you know, this chance does not come around that often. And, you know, you read about total eclipses and people who've seen them say the difference between them is literally the difference between night and day. It is, there are things you see in a total eclipse that you do not see in a partial and do not see in any other situation. So this seemed like too good of a chance to pass up. So we're flying into Atlanta and then we're going to drive either north into South Carolina or north into Tennessee on either side of the lower end of the Appalachian mountain range, depending on which side the clouds aren't.
Okay.
So it'll be a game time decision.
So this is about a 70-mile wide band, if you would, from what, Oregon to South Carolina, is it?
Charleston, yeah.
And that will be where the 100% eclipse is.
Yep.
Okay. So, Bob, Katie, where will you be? We know where Mike is going to be. Where will you be on Monday?
I might see Mike because I'm going to be in Tennessee as well. My friend and photographer, videographer, Andrew Rush at the Post-Gazette, we're going to go down in shadow, so to speak, this Pitt team and watch them do their thing on Eclipse Day. So we managed to find a motel in a place where they've been sold out. Rooms were sold out forever. And I'm embarrassed what I'm paying for a room at a Red Roof Inn, but I'm very happy to have a room at all because it's just there are none left anywhere. So.
All right, Katie, you're reporting from Pittsburgh, though.
Yes. Well, there's going to be a ton in Pittsburgh. There's one at the Carnegie Science Center. There's one at Frick. As you mentioned, CMU, move-in day, students are going to be able to watch it. But I'm going to be at the Children's Museum on the north side, talking to tots and getting their opinions on what happens when the sun goes away.
And there are events at Carnegie Science Center, of course. And so it's going to be a fun day in Pittsburgh as well. So I want to talk about actual viewing of it and properly and safely viewing the eclipse. We talked with Ralph Crewe. He's the program development coordinator with Carnegie Science Center.
There have been some fake, counterfeit, I guess, solar glasses that have been going around. If you have glasses, you want to check that they are certified either by NASA. There's a group called the ISO that is trustworthy. However, your glasses may appear to be legit and still be a fake. So one quick test is just throw them on, and if you look around the room and you can see stuff, then they're no good. Eclipse glasses, real ones, block out over 99% of the light, and the only thing you can really see through them is the sun. So it should look entirely black just looking around the environment around you if they're real eclipse glasses.
All right, Katie, you have your eclipse glasses here. Are these real or fake?
These are real. Bob and I, they were giving these out at the Pit Shadow Bandits event, and they have the little ISO requirement number 12312-2. And when you put them on, you can't see anything.
All right. Well, at least.
Well, not yet,
right,
at least.
In the studio. Okay.
What I was joking with Katie, these things are, hers are worth a lot of money right now. I did a story this morning real quick for the Post-Gazette because nobody can find these glasses, especially in Pittsburgh. I have tons of calls on my phone. Libraries are being barraged. Carnegie Science Center is being barraged. If you didn't buy them already, it's going to be really hard to get them now because it just there's a demand that's much bigger than the supply, and some people are just kind of getting on the eclipse wave now. So
right, we're getting calls in our newsroom about where can I get these glasses, and you're right.
Just give them Katie's Twitter handle and see what.
Well, you can make pinhole projectors too if you have a box of any kind. And Mike, you were talking about some of the different ways that you were going to make some.
Yeah, I actually ended up making a few pairs of eclipse glasses by getting the sheet that they use for the lenses and just cutting them out and putting them into those old, 50s era 3D, blue and red glasses. I cut those old lenses out, put the new ones in, and they seem to work fine. I checked out the sun the other day, and I can still see, so.
I think one thing you can do in Pittsburgh is if you can find one of these events, a lot of them will have glasses that they can give people, although those are going to go fast too. Carnegie Science Center, they sold out of two big orders of them almost immediately. But on some of their events on Monday, they will let people borrow glasses. You can also look safely through their solar telescope, and some paid with a little bit upcharge, you can actually get a pair of your own too. So,
what is the coolest, neatest thing that you've heard, even quirkiest thing that you've heard about people doing, whether it's a trip and a sort of a tourist trip down south or something else?
I think him making his own glasses is pretty good. That's a new one. Yeah.
Well, kind of pales in comparison to what some other people have done. I mean, there's an astronomer. I heard an interview with him a couple of months ago. He had actually moved into the path of this eclipse years ago. He has a house. He has built his life around viewing this event. So this is a pretty big deal for some people. I'm proud of my glasses, but that's a whole other level right there.
Bob?
One of the things I wish I were doing, I wish I were going with a busload of Pittsburghers that are taking a tour bus down on Sunday night. They're going to pick up like at three towns around here. They're going to go to the very heart of it, the very official middle of the eclipse in Hopkinsville, Kentucky, which has renamed itself Eclipseville. They're going to watch spacey movies on the bus on the way down, stop at the Air Force Museum, park there, and then get back on the bus and roll all the way home. I also talked to a librarian out in Latrobe that their whole family's getting matching moon tattoos.
And they're
all meeting in South Carolina to watch it. So that's a family I wouldn't mind hanging out with too if I was going to that state.
You and your wife getting matching tattoos there, Mike?
Well, I guess it depends on how much wine we have with dinner. Probably not, though. There's an Alaska Airlines flight taking off from Washington, right where the eclipse is going to cross into the is going to make landfall, I guess you'd say. They're going to take off, head out over the Pacific, turn around, and then fly back, following the path of the eclipse as long as they can. It's an invitation-only flight, so tickets are already gone for that. But I thought that was pretty cool. It's going to extend the time of viewing from 2.5 minutes to probably about 6 or 7.
All right, we have 30 seconds left, and three of you. What are you most looking forward to? Katie, 10 seconds.
Oh, I just think it's so neat how everybody's getting involved in this big scientific thing. I'm going to see the kids, so I want to see how they interact with it.
Mike?
The corona. I cannot wait to see the corona.
All right. And Bob, you get the final word.
I just want to feel it go dark and feel it get cold and feel the wind die down and just see what all the buzz is about.
Alrighty, Bob Batts is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Katie Blackley covers curiosities for the WESA newsroom. And Mike Wershagen, when he's not chasing the sun, is an investigative reporter for Harrisburg's print-only newspaper, The Caucus. Thanks, everyone, for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And you can hear special coverage of the eclipse on 90.5 WESA during Here and Now on Monday, plus live reports from Katie and reporter Deanna Garcia. Watching with the rest of Pittsburgh, join us between 1 and 3 p.m. And for this week, that's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. The engineer is Tom Hurley. The producer of the confluence, Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.